I'm Jonathan Capehart, sitting in for Leonard Lopate. 45 years ago, on August 28, 1963, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. led a march on Washington for jobs. It was attended by 250,000 people. King gave one of the most famous speeches in American history at that march. He said on that day, "I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. I have a dream that my four children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. Next week, the Democratic Party will deliver the nomination for the nation's highest office to an African American, something most civil rights leaders never dreamed would happen in their lifetimes." However, as Matt Bai notes in his New York Times Magazine article, "Post-Race, Is Obama the End of Black Politics?" a lot of the old activists stood in the path of Barack Obama's advancement. To discuss the role of black leaders, in Obama's climb to the nomination is Matt Bai, a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine and author of the new book, The Argument: Inside the Battle to Remake Democratic Politics. And I also want to note, we were hoping that the Reverend Al Sharpton would be able to join us, but he is in Memphis speaking at the memorial service for Isaac Hayes. Matt, are you there?
I am. Nice to be with you, Jonathan. Sorry the Reverend couldn't join us.
No problem. I was able to talk to him, so I'll be weaving in some of his comments as we speak. What's been the reaction to your what I thought was a terrific piece in the Times Magazine last week?
Thank you, and it's been quite extraordinary. And by the way, I have a bit of a cold, so if I sound like I'm losing my voice, it's because I am. It's not a great radio voice to begin with, but it's worse today. It's been really extraordinary. I was quite surprised. I mean, I'll be honest with you. My initial reaction, thinking about doing a piece on black politics at this moment, was I had a little trepidation, not only because I'm white, delving into a different world, but also because I felt it was, you know, sort of getting into this identity politics world, and I wasn't sure how many readers, white or black, really wanted to read at this point about, you know, a single community in that way. And I was really amazed by the reaction, both among white readers and black readers. Most of it quite positive, some of it negative, and a small amount of it quite negative. But really, just with a lot of discussion and thought, and sharing a lot of ideas with me through my website and through the Times, and really just seems to have gotten a lot of people thinking and talking. And it's very gratifying.
You mentioned a couple of times in the piece sort of not the tension, but just sort of the awkwardness of being a white journalist talking to black politicians, black elected officials about something that's cleaving that particular community. Did you find any resistance among any of the people you talked to?
A little bit. I mean, not resistance in the sense that anybody gave me a hard time, or, you know, there were some people who didn't call me back, but not most. I think it was more about, you know, worrying about, is this going to be another typecasting story? Is this going to be, can you possibly understand, and is this going to be just another, you know, set up these very stereotypical differences and create conflicts in the black community that aren't there, or exaggerate them? I think what people really tried to get across to me, and what I tried to get across to readers, was that there was a sort of gradual process and a multifaceted process going on here. It wasn't just young black leaders wanting to get rid of old black leaders, that there's a lot of mutual appreciation and admiration, and also bound up with that pride, but also some bitterness and some envy, and that it's actually a very complicated dynamic, which, you know, at the Times Magazine, I like to think we're pretty good at dealing with because we have so much space to do it. But, you know, for the most part, I think people were great. I mean, look, we don't talk about race a lot in this country. Black people and white people don't sit down and talk about these issues. I mean, you know, we have diversity workshops and mandatory courses in college, and then we go our separate ways for most of our lives and careers. And I think, you know, it was, to the extent that I wrote about some of the awkwardness, it really is about that. And it's one of the great things about this campaign that it is creating a dynamic, at least among journalists and policymakers, where, you know, we're talking about something that we've generally been afraid to talk about. And I'm not congratulating myself on that score because, as I say, I had a lot of trepidation about doing it.
Mm-hmm. You know, one person in the piece who you talk about and who is interesting to watch from afar, being at the Washington Post, was Congressman John Lewis, who started out the primary contest being a supporter of Hillary Clinton's. and then switched over to Senator Obama. Did he find himself being on, say, the wrong side of history?
Yeah, I mean, I talk about early in the piece, I talk about him running into Congressman Clyburn, the majority whip, who's an old colleague from the civil rights movement, on the House of the floor, and he says to Clyburn, all these years, everything we've worked for, and I'm, you know, we're seeing history made, and I'm on the wrong side of it. And I think, you know, I think what made Congressman Lewis so compelling, even though it was quite frustrating to the campaigns, was here is this guy who's really the legendary civil rights leader in Congress, you know, one of the great, you know, when you sit with this man, you really have a sense that you are sitting with history. I find him very compelling. And, you know, Congressman Lewis really went through this kind of personal agony. And, you know, what's interesting about this, Jonathan, you remind me, I just got a note yesterday. And I get a lot of notes from readers through my website, and I got a note from somebody who said, you know, you did a nice piece, but you didn't really talk enough about power. You didn't really get into the point, the real point here, which is that older leaders, older black leaders, don't want to yield their power to some younger guy like Obama. And it was interesting. I wrote back to the person, and I said, you know, I thought that going in. I thought that was going to be a major theme going in. But when you sit with people like John Lewis and James Clyburn, of course, Clyburn was a little more sympathetic toward Obama, but did not endorse. When you sit with some of these guys, you understand, you come to understand very quickly that this was not a power dynamic, that it's much more complicated than that, that a guy like John Lewis didn't vacillate because he didn't really want this younger guy to come and usurp him. I mean, there was a deeply emotional process that people went through owing to a vast array of life experience that's at times been very painful, and I think you have to make an effort to understand that, because that's where the really important part of the story is.
Mm-hmm. Matt, let me get your reaction, because as I said earlier, I had a chance to speak with Reverend Sharpton about this, and he said that, and I'm paraphrasing here from this conversation, he said Barack Obama brings us to a different level. He is the national level of what Governor Wilder of Virginia and Governor Deval Patrick of Massachusetts have already done. And this is a direct quote. He said, this is a graduation of the same kind of politics. And he also said, don't confuse the civil rights politics and movement with black politics. He said, this is not new. This is new people doing the same thing. And it is a way of illustrating that. He points to how you point to Valerie Jarrett, who is probably right, the single most trusted advisor to Senator Obama, and how she could be the new Vernon Jordan. And Reverend Sharpton said, you know, replacing Vernon Jordan with Valerie Jarrett, it's not new politics. You're just changing the characters. It's still about power. What's your reaction to that?
Well, I think Reverend Sharpton, as he often does, makes an excellent point, which is that this is not an entirely new thing. It's a process that's been ongoing over a long period of time, and I agree with him, and I wrote as much. I do think it's quite different in the order of magnitude, and I don't think Obama is really the central actor here. In other words, whether or not it was Obama, or whether it was going to be a Cory Booker or an Artur Davis or a Michael Nutter, we have seen and are going to see a vast increase in black political figures on the statewide and national level. Obama may or may not be the first black president, but and he certainly the first black nominee. But I think whether he existed or not, he probably accelerated the process. I'm sure he did, in fact. But over the next decade, we would have seen and we will see more statewide black officials, both a vastly larger number running for office statewide or nationally, and a much larger number getting elected. And in credit, Artur Davis, as I point out in the piece, is actually talking about running for the governor of Alabama and is considered a good candidate. And I mean, you have no state that's been more resistant to racial change than that. So what we are seeing is a real acceleration of that process on a level we've not seen before. And when that happens, I think it does change the dynamic of black politics as a whole. It does have an effect on, you know, what we consider civil rights politics and the movement, because when black leaders can aspire to that, when for the first time in African American history, when it really becomes palatable for a young, talented black professional to look and say, you know, I can get into politics and I don't have to just be a high-ranking congressman or a mayor. I could potentially be governor. I could potentially be president. That's not off limits to me. Then I think that begins to attract your best and your brightest. It becomes the focus of power in the community in a way that it has not been previously, because there were such restraints on what a black man or woman could actually achieve in politics.
Mm-hmm. I'm Jonathan Capehart, sitting in for Leonard Lopate, and we're talking to Matt Bai about his cover story on the New York Times Magazine last week, Post-Race, Is Obama the End of Black Politics? Getting into something that you were just talking about, there was one quote that leapt out at me, and I actually have met this person, and it was the quote from Cornell Belcher, who is a 38-year-old pollster working for Senator Obama. And he said, quote, "The people I work with are the new black politics. We don't carry around that history. We see the world through post-civil rights eyes. I don't mean that disrespectfully, but that's just the way it is. I don't want in any way to seem critical of the generation of leadership who fought so I could be sitting here. Barack Obama is the sum of their struggle. He is the sum of their tears, their fights, their marching, their pain. This opportunity is the sum of that." In your mind, does Cornell represent the post-race politician who doesn't want to be associated with black politics instead of American politics?
Well, I shy away a little bit from the term post-race, and I recognize that that was the headline, part of the headline on the piece, and I think it had a specific double meaning as a good headline, but I don't really use it in the piece because I don't want to suggest that we can, or frankly that we should, enter a politics that has no racial identity. I think, as Cory Booker points out, racial identity is part of the equation, just as ethnic identity has been, right? And Mario Cuomo never had to hide the fact he was Italian, so I don't see why Cory Booker has to be any less black. But I do think we are entering a different period where, as you say there at the tail end, that black politics, like Irish politics or Italian politics, becomes American politics. Those things became Democratic politics in particular, and I think that's what's happening, is a broadening of the constituency that black leaders can hope to represent, which is the natural sort of progression for communities. And I think that's, you know, that is what Cornell Belcher is in a sense talking about. I mean, it's very difficult and challenging to write about this and talk about it because it necessarily sounds disrespectful. It necessarily sounds like a conflict when you have younger black leaders saying, hey, you know, those guys who went through the civil rights movement, that's all fine and good, but, you know, we see it a different way. And it also sounds very adversarial when you have older black leaders saying, as John Lewis did to me at one point, you know, these younger guys, their souls haven't been baptized the way ours were. I don't have that quote in the piece, but he said that to me in conversation. And I think you have to be very careful and conscientious to try and let people understand that these are complicated emotions, that it is possible to have great respect for what another generation is doing or great pride in what a younger generation is doing, and to still feel that you have a different perspective and maybe even a more relevant perspective. And that's really what people like Cornell and people like John Lewis who are trying to get across when they talk about this generational difference.
Mm-hmm. If anyone out there is listening and wants to get in on this conversation, feel free to call at 212-433-9692 or send comments to our show page at WNYC.org. There was an anecdote you had, Matt, that I thought was very moving, and it was Elijah Cummings, when he was sworn in as a representative in 1996. And you write, afterward, Cummings asked his dad if he had been crying tears of joy. Quote, "Oh, you know I'm happy," his father replied. Quote, "But now I realize, had I been given the opportunity, what I could have been, and I'm about to die." That struck me because it seems that there's a, just from that comment, and you know, being African American, I know where that's coming from, that there's a whole generation of older African Americans who have struggled and are now seeing their struggles pay off in their children and their grandchildren. And there might be, in some instances, some cases of resentment.
It struck me too, Jonathan, and I'll tell you just a little bit of background on that. You know, I heard that story from somebody else, and I that sort of third hand. And I called Congressman Cummings, and he called me back. He was getting on a plane, and he said, "What are you doing? What do you want?" And I said, "You know, I told him that I'd heard this story." And he said, "Well, what are you working on?" And I told him, and he said, "I want you to come in. I want to talk to you." And it was really interesting how people responded that way. You know, Congress people are busy; they get a lot of reporters' requests. But there's something so personal about this for people, and they understand its importance. And he was really happy to talk about that, to have somebody interested in understanding what it meant. I mean, this is one of the most, you know, this is one of the trickiest things to get into, because nobody will sit there and say to you, and by the way, Congressman Cummings, I should say, was a longtime Obama supporter right from the beginning, so I'm not including him in this, but, you know, no one is going to sit there and say to you, you know, I opposed Barack Obama because I'm envious of the fact that I'm as talented as he is and I never had the chance, right? I'm not even sure people are aware if they feel that way. And I certainly don't think that's the principal emotion that most older black leaders have, because, as I say, they take a lot of pride in what he's achieved. But as I say in the piece, when I talk about that particular story, in a community that's faced oppression, any community that's faced oppression, pride and bitterness can be hard to untangle. And I do think that these things are bound up together, that you can take pride in what Senator Obama has done as an older African-American leader who's been through this fire of the civil rights movement that, you know, I frankly will never be able to fully understand. And yet also have this sense of bitterness and this sense of envy about it. It's not really fair, right, to have gone through that, to have known how much talent you had, what you could have done with the opportunity, how hard it was to open that door, and then to look back 40 years later to still feel like you're bringing value, to still be a leader. You're not retired. You're not off the scene. And look at this guy with so little experience who didn't go through any of that come breezing through that door that you opened. And I don't think you could be human and not have some conflicted emotions about that.
Mm-hmm. You know, just before we take a break, there was something that you said a second ago about older African Americans having a problem with Senator Obama. And the one who comes to mind right away is Reverend Jackson.
Yeah.
And, you know, do you think that the problem that Reverend Jackson may or may not have with Senator Obama, is that a generational conflict coming out into the open? Or do you think that that is something personal between Reverend Jackson and Senator Obama? After all, they're both from Chicago, both have run for president. One has been successful in getting the nomination, and the other one wasn't, twice.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really know how to parse that. Reverend Jackson didn't speak to me for the piece, and, you know, I mean, it's worth noting that, you know, when Henry Louis Gates wrote a wonderful piece about Colin Powell many years ago in the mid-90s, when Powell was considered the likely first black nominee if he wanted it, there was Jesse Jackson in the piece, the primary foil, sort of, you know, saying many of the same things about Powell, essentially saying that he wasn't black enough, that he didn't understand the community. So, you know, I think Jackson is sort of a singular case, the Reverend Jackson, in the sense that, you know, he's been pretty thin-skinned about other leaders coming on the scene in a different vein who weren't part of the movement for a very long time, right? This isn't entirely new with him. And his own son, of course, showed a great deal of exasperation with this when he saw his father's comments and issued a kind of blistering release. I mean,
right,
I
referred to him in the third person.
Yeah.
Reverend Jackson.
Which he often does, but yeah, it was particularly noticeable in that context. So, you know, I certainly think with Jesse Jackson there's a whole host of factors going on. Some of it is probably personal and power-related. But, you know, I've been interested in the coverage of this. I mean, I think you've got to give Jesse Jackson his due in a lot of ways. And you have to, when you think about those presidential campaigns, I mean, you have to accept a couple of realities. Because I think this is probably what goes on in Jesse Jackson's mind. He won't say it, and very few people, right, will sort of notice it. But first of all, there is no Obama without Jesse Jackson's two campaigns in the 1980s. They were seminal events, and he deserves a great deal of credit for what he was able to do around sort of broadening racial reach in presidential politics. And then also, you know, that I think he made decisions as a presidential candidate that are different from the one Senator Obama has made, rightly or wrongly. He did not attempt to talk less about black issues. He did not attempt to transcend race in some way. He, you know, he talked about civil rights issues, economic equality issues to white audiences. He ran as very much as a black candidate for president, and didn't shy away from issues of poverty or, you know, some of the issues that are more racially identified. And it probably irritates him to see Obama achieve great success by making decisions that, in Reverend Jackson's mind, may in fact be compromises. Right. Mm-hmm. So I don't know this for fact. I'm speculating, but I think you have to give some amount of credit to Reverend Jackson for the fact that he ran as successfully as he did and the way that he ran his campaigns, which I think had a tremendous impact on American politics and for which he should, you know, he can be rightfully proud.
Mm-hmm. Matt, we're going to have to take a little break, but stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Jonathan Capehart, sitting in for Leonard Lopate, and I'm speaking with Matt Baigh, who wrote the New York Times cover, New York Times Magazine cover story last week, Is Obama the End of Black Politics? For those of you who are listening and perhaps want to get in on the conversation, the telephone number is 212-433-9692. Let's go to caller two. Is he still there? Is that Peter Gold? Or is this Bob? Hello, are you there? I guess I probably messed that up. Matt, are you still there?
No, I'm still here. Anyway.
Okay. thank God for that. So Matt, there's a listener wrote into the show page. Her name is Gina. She's from Manhattan. And she says, she wrote on the comments page that Matt Baigh is asking the wrong question, that white people forget that so-called black politics arose as a necessary defense against the injustices and obstacles visited upon African Americans throughout U.S. history. She also says that the real question is, quote, with Obama's candidacy, have we come to the end of white politics? What do you make of that question? How would you respond? Or how do you respond?
I'm not sure. I don't really get it, unless Gina is equating white politics with the politics of a politics of oppression. But I think that would be an unnecessarily dim and generalizing, a very narrow point of view. I mean, people took the cover different ways. Is Obama mm-hmm. the end of black politics? And I, I'll say often I have nothing to do with the cover. I never say that. That's not the case here. I mean, I did weigh in and had some say. I think it's the right language to put on the cover. I think it's the right question to ask. And people seem to. I was surprised at the way some people. Some people come to a story about race with an expectation that they're going to be frustrated or disappointed or angered. And so a lot of people took. I was surprised at what people took away from that. They looked and said, "Are you saying that, you know, civil rights no longer matters, or that black people no longer have power in their own communities, or whatever it was that, I don't really understand that people felt was offensive about that." I mean, really, the question, as I say, we're asking there is, is there still such a thing as black politics that's all about the black community, or are we now witnessing the process by which black politicians have the same reach and the same concerns and the same opportunities as everybody else? Mm-hmm. And to me, that's a very, again, not being black, to me, that's a very positive scenario. And if anything, you could accuse the question of being too optimistic, but I certainly don't see it as a question that seeks to denigrate, what goes on in the black community or that seeks to lessen the importance of issues that do have a disproportionate impact on African Americans. But again, I can only experience it from my perspective. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there were people who experienced that question very differently.
Mm-hmm. I think Bob in Brooklyn has an interesting question about the racial factor in all this. Bob, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Bob from Brooklyn, great. Oops. Bob, are you there?
Can you hear me?
There you are. Ask your question. Sorry.
I'm just interested to know why people are so busy trying to either sell a particular race or color. We have Asians. We have other people in the world that aren't always in the front page of a paper. If you keep talking about something and you try to say that the suggestion would be that more people should of any particular race should run or to enter into this arena or that. To me, that's like trying to sell the people the idea that they should be voting for them people.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that is correct. I think it's wrong to constantly, you know, sell some particular race because, you know, you find somebody that is trying to get into office, so you want to try to help them along. I don't think that is proper. I think people should go on their own merit, and they have viewpoints and ideas and feelings about mm-hmm. things, and I think those things should be expressed, but I don't think that people should take the race factor.
Right, Bob. Thanks for your call, Bob. Matt, what do you make of that, of what Bob is saying?
I mean, I take Bob's point. I think, you know, there's a section of the piece with Mayor Nutter of Philadelphia who says a similar thing. I mean, and Mayor Nutter says, you know, why should I have to back the black guy just because I'm black? Isn't that, wasn't the civil rights movement about my being able to support whoever I want? Why are we even talking about race? Right? And so I think, and I think that's kind of what Bob is getting to the heart mm-hmm. of. But, you know, look, my view on this is a little bit different. I give that point a lot of credence in the piece, but you know, Barack Obama is black. Let's just get that.
There's no way getting around it.
He's you know, could well be president. I'm not interested in helping him along or not interested in helping him along. I'm interested in the opportunity that presents, not just for, you know, whatever advancement of race relations in America, but to talk about what this means. It means something. It definitely has an impact. It both reflects something and it moves something and it changes something mm-hmm. in our society. And I don't think the goal here should be to have a race-blind campaign. I don't think personally that the best way to go about this is to never discuss race. And if the fact that he's black comes up, it means that somebody's injecting race into the campaign. I think what we have here is a tremendous opportunity to talk about race in a more constructive way. If McCain and Obama can find, can grope their way to some more ennobling conversation about race and politics during the course of this campaign, then it's going to change the way we all talk about race in America. So this campaign should not be about excluding race. I think it should about be acknowledging it and talking about it. And I take Bob's point. I do think that Obama's race is about all races, not just the black community.
Right.
You know, forgive me. That's my phone clicking in there. But
that's quite all right. We're gonna go to Peter Gold in Rockville Center. Peter, go ahead. Are you there?
Get to the which I think is the gut of the whole election. I honestly feel Obama in his early days was a man of the people. He was out there in the trenches trying to advance the neighborhoods that he was part of. And that's what I find so refreshing about the man. What I hope he doesn't lose in the future is the fact that we shouldn't think of him as a black person, but as an American trying to do his best for what he thinks is right. I find him very fresh. I find what the French said about McCain was fascinating. He's a wonderful man. The only trouble, he's 20 years too late. He was a man of the last century. I don't mean that cruelly to McCain, but I find it refreshing that we finally have someone who in America who is hopefully not totally controlled by lobbyists or big interest groups, etc. At least we found a common man from Illinois who happens to be, in my opinion, who graduated from Harvard, who has the intelligence and the backbone, and we can finally have a president that can finally form a paragraph and talk to the American people.
Thanks a lot, Peter.
I hope you didn't laugh too much on that comment.
No, Matt.
In fact, Jonathan, I think Peter raises what is really an excellent and important point. And if I were writing about race in the broader context of the campaign, it's a point I'd really make, which is, it's very hard with Barack Obama to extricate race from generation. Mm-hmm. He represents a significant change, but that change isn't entirely racial. A lot of it is generational,
right.
And a lot of Americans are responding to one or both. And I, as an example of this, I had an interesting moment on the radio last week. I was doing an NPR show in Washington, and I was with a guest who's African American, and she said, you know, people don't like Barack Obama when he, you know, fist bumps with his wife, but that's a racial thing. I do that in my family. And I said, well, you know, I don't think that's a racial thing because I do that with my little boy, and I'm white. So that's actually, I think, a generational thing that mm-hmm. some Americans are responding to with Obama. That's not racial. That's actually generational. And I think a lot of things about him that that make older Americans suspicious is not about their racism so much as it is about their unfamiliarity with a kind of cultural shift among mm-hmm. younger Americans. And no matter what else has happened in this campaign, if you look at the dynamic during the primaries and throughout, I'm sure it will last through November, he just does a lot better with Americans of his generation and younger than he does with Americans over 50 or 60 years old.
Right. Well, Matt, Jason from Westchester has, speaking of culture, he's got a pretty provocative question. Jason, are you there? Jason, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Jason, ask the question that you wanted to ask.
Well, I just wanted to hear somebody comment about the issue, which I think is an elephant in the room, so to speak, for a lot of traditional black politicians. And it's the fact that Barack Obama, of course, is an African-American, but in all honesty, he is not part of African-American culture. He grew up with a white parent, white grandparents. He didn't know his father for, I guess, most of his formative years. He grew up in a white community. And while certainly nothing against him, that's, I think, part of the reason for the tension between traditional African-American politicians like Jesse Jackson, maybe even, who knows, the Reverend mm-hmm. Wright. But, of course, it's too much of a hot-button issue to touch mm-hmm. that, you know, he's a black candidate, but is he an African-American cultural candidate? And that is more sensitive.
Great. Jason, thanks for that question. The other point that Jason doesn't make is that Senator Obama's father was African. And before Senator Obama won the Iowa caucuses, and Matt, you may remember this as well, there were articles and symposia around the country among African American thought leaders about whether Barack Obama was, one, black enough, and two, whether because he is not of the what we would view as the traditional African American experience, could he actually identify with the struggles and the pains of the descendants of slaves?
Yeah, I disagree with Jason only in the sense that he says it's an elephant in the room and too hot to handle. I actually do mention it in the piece. It's not too hot, and I think it's a very, very relevant part of this discussion, as you very eloquently just pointed out. I mean, it's that he's, as I put it in the piece, his family didn't come to America in chains; it came on scholarship,
mm-hmm.
and that was a great line, by the way, Matt. Thank you.
Writer to writer.
Thank you. I appreciate that. That is a remarkably different experience. And look, a lot of politics, particularly in when you talk about ethnic or racial communities, is about life experience. This is how all of us make choices in our lives, right? I mean, if you feel someone hasn't gone through the same thing you have, then you don't think he shares your values or your cultural identity. So I do think that is definitely a challenge for Obama and the black community, is that it's not about skin color, it's not about whether he cares about black Americans or the issues that disproportionately affect urban black America. It's just that he doesn't share that perspective, that life experience, and it makes him suspect. And I think that's natural, and I do think it's a part of the calculus.
Mm-hmm. You know, one thing I noticed about your piece, Matt, is that, or as one friend said to me last weekend, she said, it's very heavy on the testosterone.
Yeah.
There are no women in this piece, except for Valerie Jarrett, who, if I remember correctly, was not quoted in the piece, but there's a picture of her.
She is quoted, but not so closer to the end.
Right. And so
you were falling asleep by then.
No, hardly, not at all. But I did notice, Maxine Waters of California,
right.
Stephanie Tubbs Jones, who was one of the most full-throated supporters of Senator Clinton, not quoted in this piece. Did you find resistance from them to participate, or why so many men and just Valerie Jarrett for women?
I have heard this complaint, and I was aware of it, doing the piece. I knew I was going to hear about it. It is ironic to write a piece about the end of a kind of era of identity politics and have the main criticism be that you didn't honor the identity politics of a group. I don't think of women as sort of an oppressed political class, but I have heard the criticism, and This gets a little bit into process, but, you mm-hmm. know, first of all, I did call some folks who didn't call me back. I think Stephanie Tubbs-Jones is one you just mentioned. You mm-hmm. know, the press people didn't call back, whatever. So, I mean, that happened. I couldn't, you know, chase everybody down. And I did interview some folks who didn't get into the piece, like Don Edwards, who I think is a really compelling, interesting new congresswoman. I talked to her for a while, but, you know, she's not quite yet in Congress yet, and it was a short conversation, and it didn't figure in as with as much interest as some of the other folks did. So I wasn't going to just, you know, put slots in there. Mm-hmm. I wasn't going to just, you know, give a section to somebody because it was a woman. But I also, I also think this reflects an uncomfortable reality that I didn't create, that's actually mm-hmm. I'm just reflecting, as is often the case. I mean, the only older generation folks I really featured in the piece were James Clyburn and John Lewis, both of whom have a very specific reason to be featured. I mean, Lewis is absolutely legendary. He is the seminal civil rights figure in politics. James Clyburn is the highest-ranking black official in Washington. You know, I did not spend a lot of time with a lot of the older generation of leaders in the peace period. And among the new generation where I really did focus, there are not women, except for Congresswoman Edwards, who, as I say, is a brand new congresswoman. So, you know, I expect to see a lot more mm-hmm. from her. But there is a dearth of women leadership in that generation that's now coming up. I don't mm-hmm. know why that is. I think it's a little disconnected mm-hmm. from what's actually happening
in
the black community.
Matt, we're gonna have to leave it there. We're running out of time. Matt Bai, New York Times Magazine cover story from last week, is Obama the end of black politics? Thank you so much for being with us today.
Anytime. Thanks, Jonathan. It was fun.
How long do I have? On tomorrow's show, we pay tribute to two remarkable Americans who passed away in June of this year, Tim Russert and George Carlin. They've both been guests on the Leonard Lopate Show, and tomorrow you can hear those interviews again. Tim Russert spoke about the relationships between fathers and sons, and George Carlin was here to talk about his very funny book, When Will Jesus Bring the Pork Chops? The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Sarah English, and Scott Goldberg. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Jen Poyant, Leslie Dickstein, and Angela Sheldon. Leora Noam Kravitz was at the audio controls. I'm Jonathan Capehart, in today for Leonard Lopate. Thanks for listening.